To When We Rise, Starting a Social Movement, panel number 1213. Today is Monday, April 10th, 2017. It is 10 a.m. This is some house stuff I gotta do. So a little housekeeping. We are using the Q&A app that you can get at Conference of World Affairs. In the CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. My good friend Catherine in the back corner has note cards and pencils, so if you want to write down a question, you can just raise your hand and she will come around. Also, there's this beautiful microphone. If you are oh so brave and feel like coming up to the front and asking questions, we welcome you. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also, okay, we already did that. All right, so let's get started, because this is a very amazing subject, and I'm very excited to be with these panelists. So first we have Sophia Vorel. She is a scholar and fiction writer. Writings ensue from her interests in social and political matters and their impact on vulnerable social groups and vice versa. Next, we have Karina Jagger. Good enough? Okay. Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action, a national education and activist nonprofit organization working to achieve health justice for all women, and resides in the Bay Area. Then we have Amy Fox, writes screenplays, plays, and nonfiction. Her most recent work was the movie Equity, which premiered at the Sundance 2016, and you can also catch Amy with the movie and the talkback Thursday from 5 to 7. Forgot to look at where that's at, but Amy can plug herself on that. All right, so here we are talking about social movements and quite a climate when social movements are on the rise. So my first question for the panelists is, what are you passionate about and how do you create change in the world?
Okay. Well, I volunteered to go first. For me, it was interesting when I saw the title of the panel. I was at first a little surprised and perhaps intimidated because I have never started a social movement. So I thought, dear, I'm on the wrong panel. But I know the spirit of the conference is to find your angle on something, which I certainly do have. So for me, I'd say, in my family history, there's a great deal of activism and people who did start social movements. So my great-grandparents were big labor leaders in the labor unions in the garment district in New York around the turn of the century. And then my grandparents were involved in a lot of causes, most notably my grandfather fought in World War II, came back and moved into Stuyvesant Town, which in New York is a giant apartment complex that was built at that time for veterans during a housing crisis. And at the time it was built, 1948, it was whites only, officially. And so my grandparents got an apartment and then joined a group of originally about 15 other tenants to try to pressure MetLife, who owned the complex, to admit black applicants who, it was all for veterans, and there were black veterans who had come back and also applied and been turned away. And it turned into a movement. It grew from about 15 families to about 2,000 families on the committee. It's a big housing complex. And over the course of a year, they took a lot of really dramatic action. They moved a black family that had been living in Harlem into one of the apartments illegally, and actually protected them. The veterans would come every night and wait outside the door if anyone came to bother them. They used a lot of their connections in the labor union and the press to get a lot of publicity, and it ended up turned into a situation where 10,000 people were rallying in the streets for the complex to be integrated, and it took pressure from the mayor of New York to make that happen. So that's just a little bit of my history. I wrote my second screenplay about that story because I had grown up with that story. I was very passionate about it, and I felt that it was interesting for a lot of reasons, one of which was that it was sort of pre-civil rights, pre-official civil rights, so that it was 10 years before a lot of people were marching in the streets about these things. And so I thought it was a really interesting catalyst for a lot of other housing integration efforts that happen. So I've written the screenplay. And one thing that was really interesting to me when I would take that screenplay around and get feedback on it and attempt to sell it, and it hasn't been made for a lot of complicated reasons to do with budgets and Hollywood and all kinds of things. I still hope that it will get made. But one of the things that I noticed was people constantly question the motivations of the activist characters in a way that suggested they couldn't actually believe, and this was, I wrote the screenplay about 15 years ago, they couldn't actually believe that these characters would put their own housing, their own security, in some cases their own jobs, on the line to reach out to these people that they had not met until the beginning of the story, that wasn't family members. So, for example, one of the real life characters that I had written about was a professor at City College of New York and at University of Pennsylvania, and he was fired from both those jobs because of his efforts in the struggle. He was, because of the times, he was thought to be a communist, and he was fired during McCarthyism. So I, you know, people, when I would show the screenplay to people, they would say, nobody would do that. Nobody would, you know, risk getting fired from their job or risk getting their own housing disappearing for a family they met the other, you know, last week. And I thought it was really strange because, in fact, people had done this and people had done a lot more, as we all know, on behalf of activism and social movements. And so I started to wonder, like, are we living in a time where people are just so self-absorbed or so consumed with their own security and their own priorities that they can't even imagine what it would be like to go and risk that for somebody. And this was, as I said, about maybe 12 years ago. It troubled me quite a bit coming from a family where those were the values. But then at the same time, you know, I couldn't necessarily say that I had done that. I might say in theory that I would do that, but I haven't been asked to put my own security on the line in that way yet, or I haven't done it. And so this year has been very interesting for me in seeing this rise of activism and this rise of, hopefully, I think, a sense of the consciousness again that we do need to come together and we do need to put aside, you know, I think our lives have only gotten more stressful, more complicated, more financially strained, and everyone has, I think, a million reasons why it's hard for them to go join a protest or, you know, do something even simple like make calls to their reps. I mean, everyone has a million excuses for why we can't necessarily give ourselves to something bigger than ourselves, and yet it seems more critical now than ever that we do so. And so I'm excited about the rise of activism that we're seeing, and I'm also sort of very intrigued by it as a participant and an observer, as someone who, as a storyteller, what I think about is kind of human nature and what motivates people. And so I'm both discovering my own activism, but also kind of looking at what's happening around me and trying to understand what's drawing people to do this beyond the obvious of the administration. But and what are the reasons? I think as a screenwriter, you're always looking for conflict and obstacles. And so I'm also really intrigued by what makes it hard. What makes it hard for someone to show up or for someone to get involved? And I think that I have some friends and some people in my circle who just jumped in with both feet, and they've literally overnight turned into like these radical activists. And I also have activists who've been doing it for a long time in my life. But I also see a lot of people kind of on the sidelines and kind of edging their way closer and thinking they want to do something, but they're not sure what or how. And I'm really interested in those people because I feel like for these movements to sustain themselves, we also have to reach those people. And so I'm just really thinking about those questions of like what causes someone to cross that line and say, I am an activist. I do care enough to prioritize this and maybe risk something of myself.
Thank you. Hi, so I'm Karuna, and it's really a pleasure to be here with all of you. It's my first CDA conference, so I'm getting used to the structure, and I really appreciate Amy going first and doing such a great job setting some context, and really giving a personal, engaging story. So I run a breast cancer watchdog organization, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the breast cancer movement and really the corporate takeover of what began as an activist movement and why breast cancer action is an important activist voice in a field of breast cancer advocacy. And so, you know, the way I think of advocacy is it's working within the system, and there's absolutely a role for advocacy. And activism, in my mind, is challenging the system and challenging the structures. And at Breast Cancer Action, we believe that breast cancer is a public health crisis and a social justice issue that requires systemic change. And that's what makes us an activist organization, and that's why we're Breast Cancer Action. So, you know, my very small part in this larger movement, I came to Breast Cancer Action 6 years ago. The organization is 26 years old, and really, 1990 was an interest. Early 90s was an interesting time in the breast cancer field. So I know everybody knows someone who's been affected by breast cancer. I'm sure there's, you know, many of you in the audience. I'm sure, be hard pressed to find somebody who doesn't know somebody who had breast cancer or died of breast cancer. And for decades, women were living with and dying from their disease in silence, and it was highly stigmatized, and it was an important turning point to bring this disease out of the closet, out of the shadows. But what has happened since then is companies are making billions of dollars in the name of breast cancer and really using this idea of awareness to take the air out of any efforts for change. So Breast Cancer Action was founded in 1990 by a group of women in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're now a national organization. One of our founders is still alive today. And they were angry that their doctors couldn't tell them why they got breast cancer, and unfortunately that remains true today. Most breast cancers have no known cause. Believe it or not, only 10% of breast cancers have a known hereditary link, a family link. So have you heard of the BRCA genes? So those are only maybe one in 800 women have a BRCA mutation, and all combined, those account for only 10% of breast cancers. And when you factor in lifestyle, you still can't explain more than half of all breast cancers. So we haven't come very far in, 25, 30 years. When the organization was founded, 45,000 women died every year of breast cancer. Today, 40,000 women still die of breast cancer every year. And what we're seeing is that this emphasis on screening is catching early and sometimes often non-lethal cancers, but is not changing the death rate. And so I can feel myself wanting to go down the screening rabbit hole. I'm going to pull back, and if you have questions, I will talk about that later. So let me redirect so I don't do that. So in terms of Breast Cancer Action, it was founded in the Bay Area, and those founders apprenticed themselves to ACT UP Golden Gate, which is, of course, the HIV/AIDS activist group. And so our founders, and early board members drove onto the lawns of Genentech in South San Francisco demanding compassionate access to, at the time, a promising drug, which has since become Herceptin. If those of you know Herceptin, it's really the only breakthrough drug we've had in 25 or 30 years. And I think for Breast Cancer Action, the thing that lets us do this is both our origin story. It's both our founding. It's the fact that our early board members were not satisfied with the status quo, but it's also our conflict of interest policy. And we refuse to take funding from any organization that profits from or contributes to breast cancer, and that is incredibly unique in the patient advocacy world. Most patient advocacy organizations take a lot of industry money, pharma, biotech funding, and it does shape what organizations can do and what they're willing to do. And so, you know, for many years, I really thought of that as an implicit pressure, you know, kind of relationship pressure, right? You know, you become buddies with these, you know, industry execs, you know, you have them to your galas, they invite you to their briefings, there's, of course, the check, but it's kind of an implicit pressure. There's actually known cases where companies put clauses in their grant prohibiting nonprofits from working in certain areas. So I know many of you know about the EpiPen crisis this summer, and you know, I know somebody who was working at an organization that was getting funding from one of the companies, and they were prohibited from speaking out about pricing. So really, conflict of interest is real, it's important, and I think, you know, that it's important to understand the patient advocacy field broadly, and why activist organizations are so rare. So let me just say a little bit about what I think we've been able to do with that. So because we hold out this space that lets the other organizations work within this larger framework. So I want to say that I believe there are a lot of important issues that need work. So yes, I believe we need to refocus our research priorities. Yes, I believe we need to look at access to healthcare. Yes, I believe, you know, low-income women need critical emergency support. Yes, psychosocial support is important. Yes, there's a lot of different things we need. We work more on the end of looking at the evidence from a patient-centered perspective, so testifying at FDA about drugs and devices that are up for approval. We look at root causes of disease, so looking at the environmental factors that are spurring the breast cancer epidemic, and then we do work also around pink ribbon culture and marketing. And that means that change is happening in multiple other public health, but also social justice issues. So I'm excited to be here and talk with y'all and hear your perspective.
Thank you, Mindy.
Closer? Like that. Okay. You are welcome. Good morning, everyone. Did you listen very well to me? Everyone? Okay. Thank you very much for sharing your point of view. I am a professor. I am a scholar. I am from Colombia. I am using the verb I am, the verb to be. And what did you say?
We'll get the volume turned up.
Thank you. Now better? Okay. I was telling everyone that I start today focusing in your question using the verb to be. I am. And I was telling that I am from Colombia. I am a scholar. I am a professor. It is very important for me to think about word. I don't only speak Spanish as my native language, but I teach Spanish as a second language. And with the language, it comes the culture, the habit, the values, the art, every way, every habit that we use to do, to act with our language and the representation that the language means for everyone. Then, when I was thinking about this topic, the first word that came to me was movement. And I thought about Heraclitus. He said that the principle of the movement, pardon, of life was the movement, changing. We are not the same after 1 hour of conversation with someone, after thinking about a problem, after talking about a situation, after having a good immersion in critical thinking. Then, when you ask about my passion, I was thinking that this is why I was a professor. This is the reason why I picked to be a writer and to work with words. we didn't realize that words are more than words, are act. And when I think about this panel again, a social movement, I was thinking, okay, we impact the society every day. And we impact to the student, to people that keep the conversation with us, with people that smile us, then I don't need a big population surrounded me to impact and to promote a change. This is my point of view. If I don't think in this way, I don't do anything. Because for me to wait to create a coalition could be difficult in a way that I can't organize a meeting here and see a lot of people following me. As a person from Latin America, during my career, I had to realize what was my passion. At the first time when I picked literature in my country, it was not a profession at all. And then I had to pick a profession to live off literature issues. And the only profession that was shown to me through the system was to be a teacher. I never thought I could be a teacher, and I had to learn to be one, not only with the system, but after knowing the system. I mean, when I learn, what does it mean? What does it mean to be a teacher in the system? I just started realizing what was my way to do so after knowing the system. Then, it was when I finished my PhD and I finished my long dissertation about literature that I found out my passion today. My passion before was another. My passion was to be immersed in different cultures and use my vulnerability as a way to think, as a way to grow, as a way to create impact. And today, I am facing you with my vulnerability. I am a non-native speaker of English. I also are from Latin America, and this is my first time here. But I do this with a lot of excitement because I was working in Argentina and I had a lot of students from around the world, and most of the students were from this country, trying to be immersed in the Latin American culture and then put together what they learned about culture through the books and how cultures work for them when they are experiencing these cultures. Then they have to do presentation, they have to talk all the time in Spanish, and I am doing so. Then I start now proposing you my point of view. I study vulnerability because I think that if everyone here in this audience doesn't recognize that every one of us is vulnerable to some in some ways, it is impossible to keep a communication. If we don't understand that we are vulnerable in some ways and we need each other and we are interdependent, we are not going to anyway. Then, I start teaching based in these two topics and doing research based in these two topics. Why? Has to be with language, has to be with white metaphors. When I teach compassion, when I teach vulnerability, it doesn't matter what topics I have to face in a course. When I teach vulnerability to my students, I teach them, okay, how you can learn to be kind, how you can learn compassion. You cannot initiate a movement with a clear goal, with love, with peaceful soul, if you don't recognize that you really are vulnerable, that you have a lot of stuff that have to be with your vulnerability, that you don't love about yourself, that sometimes you use what is called how we affect ourselves, trying to avoid what we don't like about ourselves, and try to fit in a society when everyone is different. Okay, I add another word to my teaching that has to be with intersectionality. I am working now with vulnerability and social difference, because we are not together in equal conditions. I am here, I am a PhD, okay, but I am from Latin America, and this is not my native language. These two conditions here in this room put me in a vulnerable situation. If I ask one of you about your social issue, about your race, about your social class, about your education, about your economic level, there are different levels of equality and inequality. Then it's very difficult to face a movement if we didn't notice, first of all, who we are, honestly, with the verb to be, who the society represents for us, because when I say I am, it is a label. I didn't pick being from Colombia. I didn't pick being Latina. I didn't pick being a woman. I didn't pick to get a lot of symbolic ways in which I embody what I am. And I can ask to every one of you if the white metaphors that are the base of our philosophy, the literature, the way we create perspectives, the way we create movement, could be maybe transpass, maybe go further when we think about compassion, how we feel with the other, how we don't feel different than other. We were talking at the first time together, Karina, and I said, oh, what a great audience. Oh, different ages, maybe different perspectives. And he said, I disagree. This is a white audience. And I like to ask to every one of you, if it is the moment to continue with white metaphor, thinking in white, yellow, brown, like is the color that represents myself here, or thinking in black, or thinking in a lot of euphemism, to create a change, to create impact. In brief, my passion is to move people to think, to move people to discover their passion, to move people to love themselves. Because if you don't love yourself, you cannot love another. You cannot go further. I teach people the appreciation for life, but the acceptance that we are all vulnerable in any way, and we have to work together for this planet. I arrived here in 2001 on August 24th, my first time to study my PhD in Penn State University. On September 11th that year, you know what happened. And then it changed the world in the way we think, but still we have, as you said, to challenge the system, to challenge the society, to challenge ourselves, to challenge our binarism, the way we think, white or black, and the spectrum. I put you here, this is your label, and I am going to talk to you in this way or in another. And this is finally my point of view. How we impact each other in every day, in a daily routine. We don't have to wait to form the group that is going to march or protest for something. But we can start changing ourselves to challenge to change the way you are looking at other people, you are looking at yourself, you are looking to me. This is my perspective. Thank you very much.
All right, so the room has filled up quite a bit more since we started. So just a few things. We are using the CWA app. So if you want to ask a question, you can submit it through the app, or you can come up to this beautiful microphone if you are oh so brave and want to ask it right up front. And we also have note cards. If you want to raise your hand, my friend Catherine will come around and give you a note card. We did get one question. First, I want to say thank you so much for each of your point of views. It was moving, even just that. So the first question that came in is, how do you see the differences in social movements based on critical theory and movements based on a Socratic method affecting their perspective issues? That's not a loaded question. It's pretty simple. So
it's so fun.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe not repeat it. Maybe explain that to me.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about differences. So differences in social movements based on different theories. How do you feel that social movements impact, like, the perspective issue? I'm trying to think of, like, I mean, you talked about it with intersectionality, about how social movements can be inflicted and persuaded or downplayed on gender versus race, or how they're played against each other. Amy, you talked about how, you know, why we move or we don't move, why we jump in or why we don't jump in. So that's, if you guys want to talk about that a little bit? Did that clear up the question? Just
could you repeat the question?
So the question is, how do you see the differences in social movements based on critical theory versus Socratic method affecting their perspective issues? So my good friend Google provided me this definition of Socratic method.
Yeah.
So Socratic method is a form of cooperative argumentative dialogue between individuals based on asking and answering questions to stimulate critical thinking to draw out ideas of underlying presumptions.
Yeah.
If you don't, I can try to answer this question first if you like.
Or yeah, go
you
for
prefer
it.
Amy, go
no,
first.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I arrived to New York around a month ago as a permanent resident. Finally. Thank you. But I am experiencing the support of the sacred city for me. And I am trying to move into the system to get support in the system. At the same time, I look into the news, Fox News, whatever news. And I am very, very, very surprised. It's a confusing time. How journalists modulate, represent the Socratic dialogue. I don't see any Socratic dialogue at all. You know, the philosopher used the dialectic way to talk, listening to each other, trying to understand what the other person is thinking about, and then try to put together different point of view, accepting different point of view. You know, after postmodernity, there is very clear that there is not only one point that supports the truth. We are working interdisciplinary to find out, for example, difference, social vulnerability, social difference, social representation. The journalists represent, in a bad way, the anti-Socratic method to talk, to find out what is going on. It's impossible to keep a person finishing an idea. The other cut immediately to each other, and they don't let to move further. And also, they forgot to find out the truth. What are they talking about? They are crazy, fighting. Then, how this kind of media is modulating politics, policies, the way that people could be very educated in policies and politics. This is only common sense. Common sense based in what? In what facts? Then, from this point of view, we need to work so hard. We need more than ever humanities. Humanities, that is the program that is going to be cut because of the budget, the system, the national government. And why? Because we do this kind of thing. We are presenting different experience, different topics, different perspectives. You are so respectful. Sit down here and listening to us. You know that when we are trying to win a contest, the only thing that we need is to push our point of view to move others to listen to us. That's all. But Socratic dialogue is not like that. It's working together, analyzing, discussing, looking for different perspectives to understand what is going on. I live in Colombia, my first 30 years, and I have to live in a civil war. And I had a great job, I had a great life, and I was feeling so miserable that I left the country and I need to be immersed in another culture. I can move, I could be clear, I think clear. I need this perspective to understand my country. And only last year, I can talk about the situation, the complete system of situation that happened in my country for more than 50 years until the Nobel Prize of Peace. Before, I was immersed in this horrible thing. I was part of this. And I remember trying to belong to a movement. I help a lot society. I help a lot this kind of neighborhood that the government led to form because they are refugees from the violence. And it was nothing. Like now in Syria, people is living, or people that is refugee from Syria, in a place that doesn't have infrastructure at all. How you can live and how you can live a decent human life in a place like in a room for 20 people without any organization, without any assistance. And I work in these kind of places. It was dangerous, but I noticed that it was not a way to do that. And people protest, and people were reunited in movement. But it doesn't work in this way. I don't like movement that generate violence. We need conversation, we need theory, we need critical thinking, we need have this kind of congregations, conference to talk and respect each other. And I hope that the day we cannot see the color of our skin, but the human being, I am working for the movement of the human being. This is a good one. This is something to add. Recycle, protecting the environment. I love that. A little thing you do, each of you, everyone, every day, matter. I challenge the system. Then, I don't know if I answer about theory, but we are working, there is a new project at University of Columbia that bring a lot of scholars from around the world thinking in these topics, but we need go further than books or a lot of articles. We need to continue with the Socratic dialogue, facing the theory. Thank you very much.
Yep. Anyone else want to?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I do teach at a university, but I teach in a film program, so I'm not steeped in theory. It's not something I feel comfortable really addressing. But I would say for me, what's interesting to me is the idea of, and what I hear a little bit in the question is the idea of how, sort of what is the place for just showing up and being angry and making yourself heard, and what is the place for thinking and pondering and theory, and you know, the interplay of those is very interesting to me. And I would just kind of share a personal experience from the Women's March in D.C., which I went to, and it was interesting to me leading up to it that, I mean, if some of you may know, and I don't know all the details of it, but I know that it was started basically over social media, right? A couple individuals who didn't have organizing experience simply put out, you know what we should do? We should, the day after inauguration, we should march on Washington, right? And then there was this sort of unprecedented response of people signing up and buying airplane tickets before there was any real structure in place. And then they brought on some very experienced organizers to try to ground it. And I remember, like, I had a train ticket with a friend of mine, and, you know, I remember, like, the first article that came out that made it clear to us that they didn't yet have a permit for the march. And we called each other and we're like, why are we doing this? There's no permit. But I witnessed kind of through that process, again, as I said, I'm so interested in psychology and what makes people act the way they do, and I felt over social media and in my life there was so many reactions, right? There were people that, you know, who cares if there's a permit? I'm going, I made my sign, I'm going to, you know. Someone else, very fearful, I won't go unless there's a permit, I won't go unless I know exactly, you know, what are the rules and regulations. And then a lot of discussion about the sort of symbolism of the march, the intersectionality of the march. Was the march, you know, so I have a friend and she refused to go, and she said, I call it the White Woman's March on Washington, right? That was her perspective. She and we talked about it. She's someone who really feels that she can't identify as a feminist until certain race issues that she's challenging have been resolved. She can't join something that doesn't start with race for this particular person, right? You know, then I had, you know, there was a friend of mine who put out a call saying, I don't know how closely anyone followed it. There was a couple days where some pro-life organizations joined as sponsors. And then there was a whole discussion, can a pro-life organization join a growing list of sponsors of a women's march, and what does that mean? And then this woman said, as long as there's anyone pro-life affiliated with the march, I'm not going. And there were all these discussions going back and forth, and it was interesting to me, and this I think is just my personal philosophy in life, but to both of those individuals and other people, I just kept saying, but why not go? Because I don't think anyone knows what it's going to be, actually. Yeah, they have these organizers, and they have, but if we're talking about the numbers of people that we were, in fact, talking about, and more, maybe you just go and see what it is. Go. If it feels like a white woman's march and you don't want to be a part of it, you walk away. If it feels like somehow it's been co-opted by a pro-life group, maybe, you know. And it was that was my perspective. I have no idea what it's going to be, who it's going to represent, how it's going to represent, but I'm going to go find out. And interestingly, my experience of going was that it was such a huge gathering that I'll say two things about it. One was that any person's individual experience of the day was radically different from anyone else's, just depending on where you were geographically and what time you arrived. So, for example, my friend and I got there very early, hoping to get close to the stage, but we ended up in this kind of liminal hell of being not close enough, but not that we could see or hear anything, but not far enough that we had any open space to use a bathroom. So we were basically penned into a really an area with like thousands of people who could not move for about 4 hours, like standing like this, not able to hear the speakers and not able to access the an exit. And that was actually incredibly challenging and also quite moving, the experience of people who were genuinely panicking in many cases, feeling claustrophobic, and yet as a sort of group in that space, figuring out how to stay calm, how to keep each other calm, how to help each other get through that experience. That was profoundly moving. There was a woman, I think she was a college student, she clambered up on this wall, which was not a safe thing to do. And she perched on this wall so that she could see the stage and the teleprompter. And then she tried to yell to the rest of us what the speakers were saying, which was sort of extraordinary. And she was not particularly, she didn't have a lot of charisma as a speaker herself. So she would say things like, "It's Michael Moore." And then we'd all wait and she'd say, "He says, call your reps." And we'd all go, "Yeah," you know, and it was like, but it's like I couldn't have told someone prior to going that that would be my experience of the march. How would I have known that that's what the march would be for me? And so, you know, just by showing up, that became my experience of the march. When I got back to my hotel that night and I met two friends who had been in other, we had completely different days. And they actually, I assumed, because it was an uncomfortable experience, we couldn't use the bathroom, we couldn't eat, we couldn't, it was very hard. There were children, which was not a smart, I mean, some people brought children and stayed on the outskirts. To have children where we were penned in was not good, and I saw a child pee themselves. I mean, it was upsetting. And then that night when I saw my friends, they had had a completely different experience. One of them had been kind of on the outskirts, showed up towards the end when everyone had started walking, had a great, fabulous time, had no idea that some of us had had a very traumatic experience. So it was really interesting because it was, you couldn't have predicted what that experience would be for any one individual, for any group. And I think in a way that's why some of the momentum created by the march, it's struggling to find its path in a way, because it was so many people and so many people that went and so many people that didn't go and people that wanted to go and people that went for different reasons. And it's hard. I mean, just on a pure logistical level, it's hard to organize, you know. But I think that the feeling of the day, even for those of us who had a difficult day, was tremendously inspiring and empowering, and also the message, right? I mean, we that night in the hotel, we came back and we watched the news coverage and we felt that it had been noticed, right? I mean, it had been noticed. And the people who needed to notice, maybe they, you know, maybe they didn't read the platform of the march. Maybe they didn't know about all the specific things the march stood for and how some of those things might even contradict each other and all the details that people I knew had been arguing about and parsing, but they saw that a huge number of people, more than anyone expected, all around the country and the world, showed up in the streets, and that had an impact, regardless of what you felt about one particular line in the platform. Now, how you keep that going in a way that all the different people with all their interests, you know, can feel heard and seen, you know, that's a huge, huge question. But I think in my personal choice, I'm always going to be the one who just decides to show up and see what happens.
So maybe just to connect each of your points, let me start by just a little story. I was also at the Women's March in D.C. I did take my kids, and we were late enough that we were moving. And as we came in on the metro, there was a couple wearing all this flag paraphernalia, right? Flag purse, flag jacket, flag. Two white people, and the man and woman. And the guys start, and the rest of the metro train is pussy hats and, you know, people of all ages, races, abilities from all over the country. It was a very diverse metro train. And this guy looks around and looked at me and, you know, starts going, "What are you doing? Where are you going? Why are you doing that? What are you doing?" And I looked at him and I said, "Hey, we're going to go march for democracy and civil rights. I see you're wearing a pin. Surely that's where you're going too, right? If you've got an American flag, I know that means you must stand for democracy and civil rights." And turned it on his head, turned it on its head. And, you know, and then he would, you know, kind of moved over and tried to target another, a woman of color. You know, "What are you doing? What's the platform? What's the policy things?" And, you know, and we just, as a, you know, as a group, just kept turning it back and saying, "These are the basic values that we stand for. And if you are wearing a flag, we're going to assume that you're standing for it too. And we invite you to come and join it and be part of it." And it was a really powerful moment on the train. And I think it does speak to kind of what you're saying about, we do have to open up conversations. We have to connect with people and we can't just other everyone. And I think that for me, you know, I care about breast cancer. I care about women's health. I care about the fact that, you know, 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer in the course of their lives and too many women are dying from the disease. But what I also believe, and the reason that this is where I'm working, is I believe that this is an opportunity to catch people who have had a profound personal experience and help them connect the dots to other important issues. And so I feel like this, the ability to use an experience or an issue and talk to people, meet them where they are, and help draw these connections. And so, you know, what I was sort of hearing in the questioner's question is kind of essentially a question, as I heard it, of top down or bottom up. Mm-hmm. And I am a firm bottom-up person. I am a person that's like, we need to get people in the room, and, you know, I think that's how the Women's March happened, and it's really how the breast cancer movement started. It's women coming together, talking about their experiences, expressing their anger and outrage over the fact that treatments are still basically slash burn poison, over the fact that, you know, nobody can tell us how to make sure that our daughters, granddaughters, sisters, friends won't get the disease. And it's women, you know, talking and asking questions and being angry and demanding more. And I think that for me is what's exciting about the work that I do.
Thank you. So we've had a lot of flood of questions, not nearly as deep, but equally as important. So after the election, there has been a big upsurge in social movements and protests. How can we keep the momentum of these movements going forward over the next few years? And also, how do we generate and maintain that interest? Like, so often we will see in media and social media, like, this is happening and this is happening, and then it just kind of, it's like a big flame that all of a sudden, like, goes out. So how do we maintain that momentum and inspire?
Well, I'll speak to what I've seen working in Brooklyn, where I live. And it's been a little bit of an education for me. I haven't been able to participate as much as I have wanted. But our local city councilman, Brad Lander, who's a New York City councilman, right after, I think like a couple weeks after the election, he called for a meeting. He called it Get Organized Brooklyn, and he asked everyone who felt the need to organize and to do something to show up. It wasn't at the initial meeting, but several thousand people showed up. It was hosted at a synagogue. I think they moved the location because they didn't realize that they picked kind of one of the only locations in that area that's big enough to hold that many people. And what he did, and I've seen a couple other activist leaders doing the same, and it might seem really simple to those of you who are already in the activist community and the organizing community, but what he did is he broke it up into action groups according to specific interest, right? So they formed about 15 groups. There's one that's focused on 2018 elections, and sort of how do we make an impact for that, particularly if you, like, you know, from our perspective, we're living in a blue state, right? So, like, is there a way that the people in a blue state, what's the best use of our resources to affect national change, right? So there's one group up for that. There's another group that has to do with the media, kind of keeping pressure on the media to make sure that stories are being told and visibility is, you know, being handled. There's another group focusing on the travel ban. There's all these groups that he formed. And they're called working groups because they do a lot of work. And it's been interesting because the groups now meet individually. And because I missed that initial meeting, I never ended up, you can join at any point, but I have a chaotic life, like I was speaking of, and so I haven't joined a working group, and I'm regretting this, because the people I know that have are really getting things done. Like, I see what they're doing, they are getting things done, and it's because, you know, they're showing up at their representative's office. They've put a lot of pressure on Chuck Schumer, a lot of the statements he's made, the idea of filibustering Gorsuch, a lot of that came not just from this group, but from the pressure from his constituents, right? There's a lot happening in these groups, and it's these small steps, right? And you do hear that, right? That you have to start local, you have to start concrete, you have to focus. And I feel like I'm the poster child for what not to do, which is that I get overwhelmed and I think, oh, I want to join all the working groups and I want to change everything. And then you end up doing, I wouldn't say nothing, but doing less. But I see it working. I see that sort of by forcing people to choose, like, you can't change everything. Start small, start local, pick the one thing you're gonna work on and give people concrete action steps. I actually am watching it happen. And I finally got to a meeting. I have two small kids and evenings are hard and they mean the evening. But I was very encouraged because I went to a meeting a couple weeks ago, and they had two things that inspired me. One was that it was just as big. I mean, it was huge. There was a line around the block. And I had kind of lost track of how many meetings they'd had. I think they meet every 2 weeks. But anyway, we got in there, and then he asked, like, how many people, you know, have been here before? And looking around, I immediately thought, oh, everyone's been here before except me. Like, you know, because all these hands shot up. But then he said, how many people is at your first meeting? And actually, a lot of hands went up. And what was great was he said, like, that's amazing because, you know, people are burning out already, right? Like, we need the new blood. We need those of you that haven't been able to come. And earlier that night, I had been, I haven't been going. I won't know which working group to, you know, it's like you can come up with all these reasons not to go. And to realize they'd had 8 meetings and they were just as excited to have me come to the 8th meeting as they might have been in the first was really important. The other thing that was really inspiring was that they had two city council members as guest speakers, one from Austin, Texas, and one from Philadelphia. And the reason they were there, it turned out, was that Brad was hosting city council members from around the country to want to mimic what he's done and want to take it back to their home states and recreate it. And that was really very inspiring, particularly hearing from somebody in a swing state and somebody... I mean, imagine being a Latino city congressman in Austin, Texas, and what you're up against in that state. And that speaker was incredibly powerful, and you could, and just the idea that, you know, it's sort of, when you live in Brooklyn, it's similar to Boulder, I think, and maybe Berkeley, it's like, you feel like, well, my community is doing pretty good, you know, how much, and so the idea that you can still build something that then also becomes a model for places where there's even greater work to be done was very inspiring to me, too.
So I thought I might share the perspective as executive director of an organization the day after election. So first, personally, this was the third year that we did a block party. So I live on a 2-block-long street in the Flats in Berkeley, and for the last 3 elections, presidential elections, we've shut down the street and projected the results live onto a sheet and with sound system, and you can imagine what that was like for Obama's first election, and I live in a really diverse neighborhood, and it was, you know, just, it was fantastic and moving. And then the Obama's second election, really powerful, and we live in a bubble in Berkeley, and we thought we were gonna get a different presidential result, and let me tell you, it was a really different experience to have this block party. So, you know, basically, people, you know, you could see, I cottoned on early, but you could see people like checking their phones and watching the news, and like you could watch who it was registering for. And a lot of folks were, some folks just sat numb in their chairs watching the screen. You know, conversation went down. Some folks, you know, went back to their homes. And really, it was, you know, the street had cleared out by 10. And so, you know, I'm like cleaning up the streets. I was, my partner and kids went to bed, and I was just listening on the radio to the concession. And, you know, and then I had to get up the next morning and answer to my kids, explain to them. And then I had to go into my staff. And we have a really fantastic, smart, passionate, hardworking group of women on staff and a fantastic culture. And so, you know, I have to tell you that two of our former staff members showed up in the office because they needed to be with us to talk and process. I had women in their 60s on my staff who were just falling apart, saying they felt that their life's work had just been undone, you know. I have young women on my staff, you know, everybody was reeling. And I had to make sense of it for all of us, for staff, my board. I had our board retreat on the Friday, Saturday. So my national board was flying in for 2 days on Friday, Saturday after the election, and I had to get us all through this. And, you know, it's hard when you're thinking about, you know, deportations, and you're thinking about the devastation to the EPA. You know, we have a proactive agenda that involves the EPA. and, you know, now the very existence of the EPA was coming under question. This is November 9th, and we don't, you know, everybody's trying to figure out, what is this administration going to do? What is it going to mean? You know, is the ACA going to be repealed day one, as Trump promised? You know, what's going to happen? And I really had to look into myself, deep into, you know, and figure out, what am I going to do? How, I work hard, I work a lot of hours, you know, and is this where my time is best used? And I believe it is. I am a really good breast cancer activist. I believe that we are making important changes in the world, and the world would be worse if we were not here. And we have a role to play when it comes to accessing healthcare. We have a role to play when it comes to calling out the unacceptable inequities in breast cancer mortality, the fact that women of color are significantly more likely to die. And we have a role to play demanding protections that are above and beyond, you know, our individual lifestyle, and refusing to accept the burden of being our own EPA and FDA, and calling on our government to do its job. We have a role to play, and it's an important role. And I want to read to you I wrote a blog post, you know, to share with our members that day. And it ends with a quote from Sandra Steingraber, the ecologist and activist, if you may know her. "We are all musicians in a great human orchestra, and it is now time to play the Save the World Symphony. You are not required to play a solo, but you are required to know what your instrument required to know what instrument you hold and play it as well as you can. You are required to find your place in the score. What we love, we must protect. That's what love means. From the right to know and the duty to inquire flows the obligation to act." And, you know, so I pledge that we're going to keep playing our instrument, and we're in it for the long haul. Sandra Steingraber wrote that not related to the election, but it, I think, is an important grounding point for all of us to think about the ways that we individually and collectively can make change, because when we join together, we are stronger than, and we do have power, and we can really change the systems and the structures that are oppressing us.
Can I ask? Oh, go
ahead. Okay, thank you. I agree completely that union is necessary always, and we have to keep working together and value the impact of everyday actions with ourselves and the other, because it is changing. We have a social works, for example, Facebook, for example, Instagram, how we use these ways to be in contact with people. In my case, now Trying to adjust to New York City, I belong to a volunteer institution that is volunteer match, and then I help from my perspective, the way that I sincerely believe I can help. And I just start going to a library of New York. They have a lot of good programs, but they need more to help people to get the literacy. For example, people from Hispanic heritage or older people that didn't know how to read, how to write, neither in their native languages. And then I completely agree with both of you and with the audience that we need to work together every day, every action you do, to work together, to work with compassion, understanding people, loving people, trying to challenge the distribution, the inequality distribution of goods in any way. It is doing a change in the world. That's all. This is my message today. I agree completely. We change the world every day with our actions, the way we think, and also we need to realize what is going on. I like to finish with the Noam Chomsky conference I listened recently, and she was trying to explain how the election were organized and how people decide to vote for one candidate or one another, and they realized that is the same way that publicity works with. Then we have to think, we have to find out the ways to analyze what is going on in front of us. We need to do this every day without being miserable or neurotics about a situation. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's not a loaded objection, so. But there's just like the last handful of questions I'm going to try and gather up into one. How do we work with opposing groups? How do we try and come together and not necessarily change each other's minds, but walk away from violence and walk away from hatred to come together and work together and try and unite or, you know, take down the system? So we have about 10 minutes, so have at it, panel.
So the breast cancer field is huge and diverse and includes groups like Susan G. Komen, which is the largest breast cancer organization in the world, and Breast Cancer Action, which is small and mighty. And we have different analyses of the problems and of the solutions. And I think that really where I'm going with this is that we are not afraid to call out the powerful, and we do campaigns. Every time we do a campaign, I call them up, I talk to them, I tell them the issue. But we also have a really strong sense of allyship. And so I feel like I maybe need to back up a little bit. I don't know what folks know. I talked a little bit about pinkwashing and about the fact that corporations sell pink ribbon products in the name of breast cancer, which can themselves contribute to increased risk of disease. Let me give you some examples. The year I came to Breast Cancer Action, Susan G. Komen, the nonprofit I was just mentioning, commissioned a perfume called Promise Me. We did independent perfumes are fragrances protected under FDA, so as a trade secret, and so there's non-disclosed chemicals in fragrance, and a lot of these are really problematic. We did independent lab testing, which found a number of chemicals of concern, including hormone disruptors. Now, breast cancer is a hormone-driven disease. Hormone disruptors not only can increase the risk of the disease, but they can also interfere with the most common treatment of breast cancer, which is tamoxifen. So hormone disruptors are everywhere, but they were in this particular fragrance, as well as, you know, one of the members of the toxic trio. And so the first thing I did was call up their CEO and tell them what we'd found in their perfume and tell them that we wanted them to recall the perfume because we didn't think people who care about breast cancer, or women affected by breast cancer, should be encouraged to buy this, putting themselves and those they love at potentially at increased risk. And you know, they ended up after, they didn't respond to my request. We had a couple of conversations, and eventually we launched a campaign. And so in that case, it's really about public pressure to force corporations, or in this case, a large nonprofit, to change their behavior. But it's one thing to go against a big organization that is really in the pocket of industry, and it's another thing to go after groups where we have a lot in common and may not have as much power as us. And so we have a pretty deep analysis of power, and so there's an organization right now called MetUp that's also, like us, founded kind of modeled on ACT UP as an activist group. They just started a few years ago. They've been doing die-ins in DC to draw attention to metastatic breast cancer. So again, not knowing what folks know, when breast cancer stays in the breast, it's not fatal. It's only when it spreads to other vital organs that it metastasizes and is fatal. And you know, despite all this awareness from the Pink Ribbon campaigns, most people know shockingly little about breast cancer. And many people think, well, hasn't that already been taken care of? I see pink ribbons everywhere, you know, like we're raising money, we're walking, isn't it all good now? And so MetUp has been doing direct actions, has been doing die-ins to draw attention to the fact that 40,000 women each year die, to draw attention to the fact that very little research funding goes into metastatic disease, which is, after all, what kills women. And yet, there are policy positions that we disagree on. And those conversations I can have behind closed doors. And so to me, I'm really trying to answer this question of, like, how do you work within a field where there's a lot of different views? And I think you start with a conversation, and when the big and the powerful are non-responsive, we may launch a campaign to get the response that we want. And that's not always an appropriate tactic for all organizations.
Yeah, for me, this question of, you know, how do we sort of talk to each other, and particularly, you know, right now, which not being as, in a, such a specific field as you, for me, it's, you know, it immediately is, of course, like red state, blue state, Trump versus Hillary, or Democrat versus Republican, right? We fall into these categories. And I feel that it has become increasingly difficult, and I feel that as it should, in a way. I feel that I don't bemoan the fact that I used to have a lot more Republican friends that I would have really interesting conversations with, because I feel that the positions that group increasingly takes, I shouldn't necessarily have those friends. Now, does that mean I shouldn't speak to those people? No. But I do, for me, what I'm interested in is sort of, yes, I think we have to talk to people that we really disagree with. I think we have to take care of ourselves first. To your point about kind of loving yourself, vulnerability, I know that for me personally, I could not have spoken to a Trump voter. I don't think I could now, but I think for many months after the election, I could not have. And then people would say to me, well, how are we going to reach them? If we can? You know, of course, but you do have to know what you need at any given time. I mean, I actually couldn't speak to Bernie supporters for a little while. And I had a really interesting conversation with one woman, just speaking about kind of starting small. And yes, this woman and I have a lot in common in our politics. But interestingly, she had been an early Bernie supporter. She had voted for Hillary. She was one of the people who were walking around after the election saying Bernie would have won. I was a very strong Hillary supporter, and that reaction was setting me off in an extremely emotional way. And so she and I we met at an activist meeting after the election. We were getting along great, we had a lot in common, we're both screenwriters, and then we got into that moment, and I got very upset. And then she got upset, and then I just, like, took a breath, and I just said, like, let me just explain to you, like, we were in this argument of how do you know he would have won, who can predict? And then I just said, like, let me explain to you what it feels like as someone who supported Hillary, as someone who thinks that women have, that everything is always turned against them, that no matter how hard they try, they will be maligned, that a man sort of always comes along in the 11th hour and people go like, oh, we thought we liked this woman, but now there's this guy and he looks fabulous. Anyway, I just explained to her what it felt like to me and why I could not hear from people that sentiment. And it was really interesting. Like, she didn't say much, and then we sort of parted ways. She actually wrote to me a couple weeks later, and she said that she wanted to take me to lunch. And I was like, all right, you know. And we went to lunch, and basically she's a very involved activist, and she basically said that she had that same conversation, that same argument, like 20 times in a couple weeks of an election. And she said that for whatever reason, and I don't mean this as like to stroke my ego, she said that I was the first person where she heard why that argument was happening, like where that pain was coming from. That with everyone else, she got defensive, they got defensive, and that I actually created some change in the way she thought about it. And so she, when she took me to lunch, actually, she said, I think you have a talent for speaking to people. And, you know, what, and she's interesting as a, she's got an approach where she's trying to build activism, and so she goes to people and she says, like you said, like, what's your instrument? Like, she's like, I think you have an instrument and you're good at playing it. How can I help you plug that in where it's needed? Which is kind of what she did with me. But it was really interesting because, I mean, I just had to really think about communication and storytelling and, like, what did I do in that conversation that caused her to listen? And it was something about just telling a story that came from an emotional place. Now, I'm not so naive. I don't think that's I'm gonna have some breakthrough with, like, a really deep-seated Trump supporter. That's, you know, this woman and I are probably 80% aligned in our politics, so it was not that hard to move the needle. But I do think that it's that same process. It's that same kind of quality of how do we talk to each other? When do you say, like, I can't talk to you right now? At this point, I've come so far, I've been reading so much and talking so much that I've actually become far more interested in Bernie than I ever was. During the election, Bernie was a threat to my person, and now I'm like, thrilled to talk about Bernie's strengths and weaknesses, but it's taken me a while to get there because I just think it's about knowing what you need to strengthen yourself so that then you can bring that ability to communicate to someone else.
Thank you. Sophia, we got 1 minute.
Sorry.
In 1 minute.
Okay, thank you. I had the fortune to work in multicultural environment with students from around the world and people from around the world, and then it is my pleasure to work with them together to understand that when we learn a language, we learn about different culture. We are immersed in different culture. Our brain became flexible and we changed a lot our perspective about war. And then after that, I delegate to everyone to work in an intercultural environment, and this is the way that people finish the semester changing their minds and understanding that there are values, ways, different ways in which people think, act, has habit, have a spiritual sense, etc. Then this is my perspective about it.
Thank you very much.